Good evening and welcome to Transatlantic History Ramblings with Lauren and Brian. This is Brian in Buffalo, New York, U.S. of A., and with me, as always,
is Lauren from Swansea. How are you, Brian?
I am in a little bit of pain, but that's okay, just more sciatic issues, but I want to tell people right off
the bat. Bathroom buddy.
I do. The bathroom buddy is a game changer. It is, Lauren. But I want to tell people, when you hear the interview today, which was pre-recorded, you're not going to hear me for like 95% of it because it was recorded at about 4 a.m. my time. So I popped on at the very end.
It's 5 a.m. your time. It was 5 a.m. your time.
No, when we logged on, it was before 5.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. But don't be sorry. We got to do a great interview with Dr. Estelle Perron. Don't you like that, Lauren? You love it when I say things in French. Perron.
I do, because I have such anxiety over saying people's names wrong that I tend to not say their name at all.
Well, I'm going to say Perron, because that's how I would say it in French. That might not be how she says it in French, but that's how I say it in French. Let's call her Dr. Estelle. How's that? No, but Dr. Estelle Perron, who is eminent historian. She's just absolutely brilliant. I absolutely love her, and I wish I could have been on for the whole time, but it was 5 a.m. my time, Lauren.
Well, the thing is, though, Brian, let's be honest. I was quite happy to record the episode and send it in to you or let you log on to Skype and do it that way. But you were like, no, I must be there to repress record.
Well, it's easier to edit on my end when I do it that way. But either way, the interview is absolutely riveting, folks. I mean, this is, you're talking about two incredibly brilliant, smart women talking about two incredibly brilliant, smart women. How cool is that?
Oh, no, I don't think you can call me smart when I'm in a room with Estelle.
There's levels of smart. You're both gingers, though, so you got that going for you.
Is that a backhanded compliment to me, Brian?
That you're both gingers?
No, that there's levels of smart.
No, that was a total compliment, Lauren. I wouldn't know what you mean by me thinking that. No, I mean it, and it's amazing. But we'll be coming to that later. We got to, you know, do our ramblings to start the show, Lauren. So as I always ask, how you doing?
I am very nervous and anxious at the moment because in exactly 1 week's time, I will know if I have a master's degree or not.
Well, I can make you even more nervous. I could try to get you to say Dr. Estelle Perron.
Okay. No, don't let me know.
I know. It's weird. You Welshies don't like speaking French. I wonder, is it just like the accent that it's too difficult for you to do?
No, I can speak French a little. Like, I do have, like, I did French GCSE when I was in school, so I can speak a little bit. Like, I can speak enough to get, you know, by.
You know what's funny?
It's just
you know me. You know that I'm, you know, I could speak French pretty well. At least I thought I could until I was in France. And they all told me that I spoke like I was from Quebec. So apparently my French is more French-Canadian than French-French.
Oh, but no, they have beautiful French. Because
not to the French, they don't.
No, well, apparently British people to French people sound like French teachers, you know, teaching French as a second language, French teachers, which is probably about right.
But you know what they have in Quebecois that they don't have in France, or that I didn't see in France? Poutine. You ever eat poutine, Lauren?
We have poutine. Yes, I eat poutine quite regularly. There is a bar in Swansea that sells poutine. Right. Lots of different varieties of poutine.
But is it genuine poutine? What's on the poutine?
Cheese curds.
Mm-hmm.
And gravy.
That's just the plain basic. Okay, you use curds. Yes. That's right. Cheese curd is what you're supposed to use. See, a lot of people that think they're eating poutine, they're not using curd.
The squeakier, the better. They need to squeak to be... Because the more they squeak, the fresher the curds are.
Okay, this is just starting to sound obscene.
Yes, and sometimes I have some paprika and bacon bits and chives. You can have one with pulled pork on it. Really nice.
Yeah, there's a place in Buffalo that's actually called the Poutinery.
The one in Swansea is called Pucking Poutine.
But ours, yeah, they have like 30 different varieties of poutine on the menu in this one. Greek poutine, which just is bizarre to me, but wonderful stuff. Not wonderful for your health, but good stuff.
Oh, it's a treat. It's a treat now and again.
And, you know, I got to do something before we get too deep into the show. And this is especially for our dear friend, Misha Malcolm, who we love.
We do.
Great friend, great fan of the show, and the designer of our logo, by the way, folks.
Yes.
I want to congratulate her because her Colorado Avalanche won the Stanley Cup last night. Being a Detroit Red Wings fan, I fucking hate the Colorado Avalanche, but congratulations to Mika. She loves them, so.
And also, she is going back to university in the fall.
She is. But she might be coming up. She would be making a trip to Buffalo. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Yeah, she was actually planning on a trip to Buffalo before the pandemic. But now that things are loosening up around here, she might be coming in, not really to Buffalo, more to Niagara Falls to see the falls and all the sights. But she will make a stop off in Buffalo to go to Duff's with me.
I thought she was vegetarian.
Well, she said she'd make an exception for Duff's. Best wings on the planet? Fuck yeah.
She's been vegetarian for years, though, Brian.
Well, I'm a bad influence. What can I tell you?
I know. So, yeah, it's a very nerve-wracking week because I might be a master of the medieval prison by the end of it.
You know, it's been a weird week all around. Did you know there was the most amazing scientific discovery of our lifetime happened this week, and it seems to have gone unnoticed?
I didn't know that. What did they?
They actually figured out time travel.
You didn't? No, they didn't.
Yes, they did. The Supreme Court of the United States put America back 75 fucking years.
Oh, yeah, that.
Jesus, traveled back in time 75 years. And you know what? Michael J. Fox is a little too messed up right now to go fix this shit. So.
Can I just tell you something? When Margaret Atwood wrote The Handmaid's Tale, it wasn't an instruction manual. It was very much a warning.
Well, this is actually, it's even worse than Handmaid's Tale. I think that the people who passed these... draconian laws really want more Stepford Wives. They want mindless, thoughtless automatons who, you know, have no rights and no say. And you know what? People get out and fucking vote. I don't care where you are. Well, if you're an American, get out and vote. Sorry. Because if we don't vote these people out of office, this shit's going to continue. Yeah, 2/3 of the country wanted this to not be touched at all. And then the third that did want it overturned, only like 5% wanted it completely overturned. But you know what? Apparently, it doesn't matter what the fucking American people think. It's just what a bunch of zealots think. And anyway, we can't go down this road now, Lauren. I'll get too upset.
I understand why you're upset. I'm upset too, because my concern is that what usually starts in America does travel around the world, and it is something that we've got to be mindful of. And the thing is, you know, they've come for women's rights now, but they won't stop there at women's rights.
No, that Justice Thomas, in his letter for this, actually said this is the first step. There are other things they want to go after.
You know, and what concerns me is I understand that they've not outlawed abortion where it can save a life. But the consequence of not having these practitioners in the areas is that there will be nobody there to perform these, you know, perform it as a life-saving operation. I mean, you know, in cases where there's been an incomplete miscarriage, and to avoid toxic shock, you know, what has unfortunately not been expelled by the body has to be removed, and because you don't have these practitioners there, and you have no, and you have doctors who are, you know, are very afraid of being sued.
Yeah, and in reality, Lauren, you're missing something. They claim that when the mother's life is in danger, that that's an exception. It's really not. If you read it, it has to be.
Oh, no, I understand that, because once you take it away, once you take it away.
Well, even the way they passed it now, it has to be certain. Sorry. So if the doctors say, you know, there's like an 80% chance that you will die giving birth to this baby, that's not good enough for this law. If it's not 100%, you got to carry. No, it's worse than you think.
No, I understand that. I know, I absolutely understand that, because I know that they've said that. But my point is, and I was, you know, it was a very long trying to please both sides point. But essentially what my point is once you take away the ability to do it, once you take away the you know, the practitioners and the nurses that do these in these clinics, you take it away for everybody, because there is nobody there to do it. So yes, it might save a life, but where is that person who desperately needs their life saved going to go, because there's nobody that does it, because it's gone. It's been closed down.
Yeah, well, the hypocrisy is disgusting. The same fucking day they did that, they also overturned a law that New York had restricting guns, saying, oh, the state can't make that decision. That's a federal thing. And the same day they said, however, abortion states get to make that decision, not us. So basically, guns won, rights of humans zero.
Was that about carrying guns as concealed weapons?
Yeah, because that's always a good idea. I don't know. We got to get off this topic, Lord. I'm going to go to some jokes to get it, to cleanse our palate and get us off this topic before we get too depressed. You want a joke?
Yeah, go on then.
What's the difference between a hippo and a Zippo?
I don't know.
Well, first off, one is really heavy, and the other one's a little lighter.
That's good.
That was a good one. And I got, you know, I thought of one especially for you, Lauren, because by the time this airs next, or, well, this airs tomorrow, but by the time the next episode airs, you'll have a master's degree in medieval.
I don't know about that. I might have failed. Let's just put that out there.
Well, you know a lot about the medieval times, right?
I'd like to think so.
Do you know why they're called the Dark Ages?
Because nobody knew how to turn a light on?
No, because there were just so many knights.
That is true. That is true.
That was kind of weak. I'm going to do one more joke. One more joke. And then we can go on to our days in history. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Why do ducks have feathers?
I don't know.
To cover their butt quacks. You knew I'd do a joke like that eventually. I feel better, Lauren. I'm a little cheered up.
Yeah, I do. I mean, it's quite interesting that we are talking about women's rights when we're talking about two women who had a lot more freedom than a lot of women in their era. It's very interesting that, you know, that is sort of, you know, the thread that ties the introduction with the interview is that we are talking about two exceptional women with a very incredible woman.
Not only, you know, two incredibly brilliant women discussing two incredibly brilliant women, it's a lesson to the people listening, especially our American listeners, that these weren't just two women. These were two women rulers, leaders. Hey, maybe I should run for office. And you know what? I have a couple slogans I could use. Running my political slogans.
You could run with Batboy.
I could. I could be Batboy. You're telling me I'm Sasquatch? Lauren, did you just call me Sasquatch?
Not directly, but maybe.
Maybe. Okay, ready? Hear my campaign slogans?
Oh, God, yeah. Why not?
A Duff's chicken wing in every pot. Now? Okay, Lauren, how about this one? I'll clean up America like the bathroom buddy.
I knew that was coming.
Yeah. All right, on that note, how about we go to Today in History? You know, since we're going to be talking today, or you will be talking today for the most part, about very influential and important historical females, my day in history is a very inspirational historical male. Because today in history, June 27th, 1890, Canadian bantamweight George Dixon stops the English bantamweight champion Edwin Wallace in the 18th round to become the first ever recognized world champion who was black. The first black man to become world champion, George Dixon, today in history, 1890.
That is amazing. So I am sticking with the 16th century.
Of course you are.
Yes, of course. Well, that's where we're going back to. And one of my favorite years, because it is a year that will be part of my book, but not for the reason that it is my today in history. So on the 27th of June, 1542, Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo set sail from the Mexican port of Navidad to explore the west coast of North America on behalf of the Spanish Empire. Now, I would question the use of Spanish Empire here because, yes, Spain was an empire, but mostly because they were part of the Holy Roman Empire. So it's kind of interesting to know, was he exploring for Charles V as the King of Spain or as Holy Roman Emperor? We will never know. But
I want to know, did you say, where did he set sail from?
Navidad.
Isn't that Christmas?
I know. I saw that. I think I'm sure that's Christmas.
Well, no, I'm serious because you said in Mexico, right?
Yes, Navidad. Please, Navidad.
Well, no. Well, exactly. But I didn't know that in the 16th century, if Mexico was a Christian nation, which now I know they must have been.
Well, you would have had the conquistadors over there, wouldn't you?
You would think, yeah.
So Spain was there. I mean, so they were Catholic, a little bit Catholic.
No. Didn't they do something called, like, this little Inquisition?
Yeah, they did. I love Inquisition.
That's uber Catholic.
Spain was an empire, but it was kind of part of the Holy Roman Empire as well, because the monarchs of Spain tended, after a certain point, to be the Holy Roman Emperor as well. I like the Holy Roman Empire.
You know, Lauren, I like the Spanish Inquisition when it's used in comedy. So I want to ask, which is funnier? The Inquisition song from Mel Brooks' History of the World Part 1, or Nobody Expects the Spanish Inquisition from Monty Python?
I was say that, yeah. My parents went to Spain once, and they went and I think it was Cordoba, and they're in Cordoba, and they went past a Spanish Inquisition museum. They were so terrified by the gift shop they didn't go in.
Whoa! There's a gift shop at the Spanish Inquisition museum. Okay, that's just in bad taste.
Well, you need someone to go and get your pencil and your pen and your ruler.
What do you get, like a Torquemada pen? Is it one of those ones where you flip it upside down and his robes come off? I would buy that if there's a Torquemada pen. Do you remember those pens, Lauren? Wait, you'd flip them over and the woman's bikini would come off?
No, but I remember the ones where you could tip them upside down and you'd have boats sailing along and stuff.
Yeah, like that. Similar. But it was like, you know, they sell novelty ones where, like, the ladies' bikinis would come off. If they had a Torquemada, you flip it upside down and his robes come off, that would be funny.
There would be.
But what else would you get in a Spanish Inquisition gift shop?
I don't know. I wasn't there.
Thumb torture devices, or?
Don't, because that's just going to give Theo ideas.
No, keep Theo away from Spain.
Yeah, Theo's been to Spain. He's been to Ibiza. He likes Ibiza. Staying with us a week. He's asleep now.
He's staying there a whole week?
His mum's gone back to Ibiza for a holiday.
That beautiful, beautiful red hair of yours is going to be gray by the end of the week.
He's all right.
Yeah, so you claim. He never found a bomb in your backyard.
His mother did that.
Exactly. Apple don't fall too far from the tree, Lauren.
I know.
But I say we fire up the magic interview box.
It's the magic interview box.
Yes.
We're going to bring you this interview with the brilliant Dr. Estelle about her new book. Lauren, before I flip the switch on the interview, why don't you tell the people about what the new book is?
The new book is called Blood, Fire, and Gold, and it is about the relationship of Catherine de Medici and Elizabeth I. And spoilers ahead, but it isn't always the most easy relationship. I mean, they were both fiery women with strong opinions. Of course, it was going to be tempestuous.
Yeah, so buckle up, folks. We're bringing you the interview now. I'm going to flip the switch.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you? I'm so excited to talk to you. I've heard lots about you. We've got a mutual friend in common. And she said so many lovely things about you. So I'm really excited to talk about your book, Blood, Fire, and Gold, Estelle. It's going to be amazing. I've heard other podcasts that you've done talking about these two remarkable women. And it's such a shame that your biography is the first time they've been discussed together, because, you know, they are such examples of two different types of queenship and two different types of female power in the 16th century. Though it's very strange.
It really is. And I think that's mostly because I think Mary Stuart, I think the rivalry between Elizabeth I and Mary Stuart, overshadowed basically Catherine de Medici. And also because she had such she has a bad reputation, she has a bad legend, she has a dark legend, you know, stained on her and on her reputation. That means that everyone is completely overlooking her and her achievements. And I was as surprised as you that there was no biographies of their relationship. And I'm glad, because obviously it meant I could do it. But it was quite surprising for me as well.
Yeah. It is surprising because, you know, Elizabeth herself, when she comes to the throne, she equally has a stain on her character as well. Not necessarily through her own doing, but from her parents and her sister. That, you know, they equally have a bad reputation, I think.
Well, I think you're right to mention that. But what I mean is, Catherine de Medici didn't have a stain. Like, she just has a tragic childhood. She didn't have a stain when she arrived in France. The stain of her reputation is more later. Is like, it's linked to the religious civil wars. It's after her death. The Valois and herself are completely vilified for the Bourbons to kind of be the big monarchs and great monarchs that they became. Well, allegedly, I mean, that can be disputable, I guess. But that's why it's so interesting as well. Like, I do think they have lots in common. I do think there are lots of differences between them as well. But I think they do have lots in common in terms of personality. They really had similar personality, not for everything, but I would say the basics were actually really similar.
Do you think if we removed the letter writing and the diplomats that sort of fostered and stewarded the relationship between them, that they would have had a different relationship? That if they could have met face to face and knew each other better, that their relationship would have been very different.
Funny enough, I don't think it would have been the case for Elizabeth and Mary, but I think, well, Mary Stuart, but I think it would have definitely been the case for Elizabeth and Catherine. It's one of the, I can't remember now, like, who, which ambassador said it, but maybe Lamont Fenelon, or maybe it was an English ambassador. I can't now I'm like having doubts. It's in my book anyway, but basically, yes, there's definitely, like, one of the ambassadors said, if only you two could meet in person, I'm sure it would be good friends or something like that. It was not as clear as this, but it was basically saying this. And reading their letters, knowing them through the letters, I really believe that it is true that things would have changed. That I don't know if Catherine would have convinced Elizabeth to marry, but I think she would have understood what Elizabeth meant when she said she wants to be loved as a woman and not as a queen. And I think she would have seen, you know, in person, you kind of like have different vibes. You give your, you know, there's the body language, there's the discussion you can have on the side. And I think that if they had had some time, like, alone, you know, not necessarily completely alone, because I think when you're a queen or a king, like, you're never completely alone. But what I'm saying is, like, without a formal, official, you know, meeting, I think she would have probably, I think Elizabeth would have probably opened up about how serious she was about not marrying. Because the truth is, Elizabeth never wanted to marry. It's very clear from the very beginning of her reign that she's something she's really not keen on. And it doesn't mean, you know, like, sometimes you can make a decision, you're 25 and you're going to be 35, you're going to be 40 and you're going to change your mind. And it could have happened. And I think she was very close to change her mind with Francis of Anjou. But no, like, I think all things considered, she was like, no, that's not going to work for me. That's just not going to work for me.
You can't really blame her for not wanting to get married, really. I mean, it wasn't just that she saw, you know, her own mother was executed, one of her stepmothers was executed. She also saw women die in childbirth, you know, she also saw when, you know, matches didn't go too well. And the thing is that, you know, I know Mary early, Mary, Elizabeth's sister, was prepared for marriage in, you know, early on when she was betrothed to Charles V, but you never get that for Elizabeth, so they were never really prepared properly.
You have some discussion, like, you have some matches discussed when she's a princess for Elizabeth, but I think that it, regardless of that, you're right, like, I'm not sure if her fear of marriage is linked, as much as we would like to think, that to her mother's death, it might be, but to her mother's death or her stepmother's, you know, Catherine Howard's death. I think it's a combination of different things. I think it's the fact that all her childhood and teenage years, that we want it or not, and that people can argue it, but for me, Elizabeth is in a survival mode. And that's why she's so humble. That's why she's so modest. That's why she's trying to please Catherine Parr. I mean, the letter she writes to Catherine Parr, like, there's utter devotion. The letter she writes to Edward when he's a king, utter devotion. The letter she writes to Mary when she's queen, utter devotion. You have someone who's scared for her life. There's someone who never takes her safety for granted. And I think that plays a major role, that once she became queen, she kind of like attained this safety, this sense of security. And going through a marriage to have a child, because that's what she says. She says it in front of her parliament. She would never consider marriage if it was not for the succession of our country. And going through childbirth is not, she knows that, you know, I think she's more shocked by Jane Seymour's death, and she's more shocked by the fact that, and the fear of having a man who's going to control her or control the country, remove the sense and feeling of security and safety. I think that's what she's so afraid of. I don't really think that it's just a question of marriage. I think it's everything else that is so scary for her. And I also think she loved power. I think she extremely loved power. It's the same with Catherine de Medici. Catherine de Medici loved power when she, and she never thought it would happen. But when she becomes like everything but in name, Queen Regent with Charles IX, she's obviously, there's no discussion about her marrying again, remarrying, you know, like she's really happy being the Queen Mother and she's really happy, you know, not having a man, I mean, apart from her sons, but not having a man telling her what to do and putting her on the side again. So I think for both of them, there's this, I think there's this need for control. I think you can, you know, if you're going to think about it really clearly, I think both Catherine and Elizabeth have a strong need for control because they had no control whatsoever for a long period in their lives.
I agree with that too. So with Catherine and Elizabeth, we see two different types of queenship, regnant and consort. So what can bringing their story together tell us about queenship in the 16th century in a broader context?
Well, you're right. So we have a queen regnant and we have a queen consort. But both, like what's amazing about both of them is that one is declared a bastard at three. One is an orphan after being a month old. And in so many ways, I mean, obviously Elizabeth is an orphan and not, you know, because she lost her mother, right? Like, I mean, it's being motherless is quite huge, even at that time. And so we have really like two types of queenship, but for Elizabeth, the Queen Regnant is obviously not a straightforward title because some people would not recognize her legitimacy because of what happened to Anne Boleyn, her treason, her execution, the fact that, you know, there's a break with Rome, so lots of Catholic countries don't have a hard time. They will. Like, apart from Mary Stuart, who refused for a long time, everyone else, like, gets in line. I mean, and the Pope, obviously, but everyone else gets in line. I mean, the French kings and stuff get in line and do recognize her, even if they say different, even if they say stuff at the French court that are, obviously show a lack of respect. They try officially not to show any lack of respect, which Mary Stuart and Francis II didn't do. And it's where we have the rivalry created between the two cousins. And for Catherine, she was not meant to be queen consort. She was married to Henry, who was Duke of Orléans, and who was like the second son of Francis II. So there was no, like when she was sent to France, to Marseille, there was no way that she thought about the crown or the throne. She was married to the second son. She was not that as important enough to be married to the Dauphin of France. But when the Dauphin of France dies, and then it's obviously Henry and Catherine who became Dauphin and Dauphine, so the heir to the throne, there's something really powerful here because then everything fell into place for her. But when she's queen consort, she has very, very little power. She has little respect from her husband, at least at the beginning. I think at some point towards the end of his reign, he starts recognizing that his wife is maybe, you know, a bit smarter than he thought she was. And her true power is not being a queen consort. Her true power is when her husband died and her first son died. Like, she needs both of them, unfortunately, to die. Actually, there's a chapter in my book that's called like When Death Brings Glory, because it's exactly what happened for Elizabeth, you know, in 1558. She has to lose her sister. Both of them have kind of to lose everyone before being able to attain any form of power. And not completely everyone, because obviously Catherine has her children, but Catherine still needs to lose her firstborn and her husband. And when she does, she should have been like, I mean, someone else, another woman, another mother, would have let, you know, Antoine de Bourbon be regent, so King of Navarre, being Prince of Blood, being regent, and let him kind of rule. The fact that she chose him, or she managed to have people choosing him, what she wants is someone who's away from Paris. She gets what she wants. And then she manages to convince the parliament to call her governor. you know, gouvernante, not regent. But again, she's regent in all but name. And by being governor, she changes her title again, and she asks to be called Queen Mother. And Queen Mother is something very unique, because Louise of Savoy, mother of Francis I, was called the mother of the king. Okay, so and she got her power through being the mother of the king. You have Queen Dowager, so they're the ones who have lost their husband, but they have literally no power. They sometimes, you know, if they're foreigners, they have to leave France. It's what's going to happen to Mary Stuart. Mary Stuart is asked by Catherine to leave France and to return to Scotland in 1561. And she would have been happy to be a Queen Dowager in France, but Catherine cannot trust Mary Stuart, which is not surprising, is it? But you know, like, who can trust Mary Stuart? I mean, honestly. But, and so you have, like, Queen Mother is a title where you have two important terms, Queen, like Queen Regnant, Queen Consort, Queen Mother, and Queen and Mother, which shows that she obviously gets her power through motherhood. And it's something that she's going to discuss a lot with Elizabeth, because for her, you get power and you get safety only through your children.
Yes.
And mostly through your sons. Yes. But Catherine was really happy to have daughters, because when you have daughters, they're political pawns as you create dynastic alliances. That's what she's done with all her daughters. Marguerite, for being like the most difficult one to settle and to tame. I mean, she's untamable, this woman was absolutely untamable. But the other two were really like, I would say good girls, like kind of listening to their mama and doing what she wanted. But so, yeah, so that's the difference of queenship. And obviously we have over the types of, I think it's very hard to talk about queenship as a whole in the 15th and 16th and 17th century, because all these women who were having real significant political power, diplomatic power, were also all very unique in their own way, the way they chose to do things. Mary I was very unique because everyone was like criticizing her for marrying Philip II, which is no surprise that she would do something like that. She was very keen on retaining her power in England. She was very keen on not letting him having full control of, you know, the decisions making, and actually, you know, being still very much in charge. And we kind of dismiss that. But if you look at all these queens that were like in power in the 15th or 16th or 17th century, regnant or not regnant, consort or not, you know, like you realize that they all do things kind of differently. It's all very unique. It's all in their own way. The thing that's very unique about Elizabeth is obviously like that she's the only single. She's the one to decide not to marry. And the only thing that's very unique about Catherine, though there are other women with kings and sons and everything, is the way she's going to use that, her motherhood, her relationship to her sons, to retain, to maintain, to protect her political power.
I know that, sorry, this is going off the questions that we agreed, but it's something I thought of. With we've talked a bit about Catherine understanding Elizabeth's reasons not to get married, but do you think that, you know, I know that she tried to get her sons to marry Elizabeth, but do you think that on a more woman, on a more intimate level, on a level as just a woman being concerned for another woman, that she was concerned for Elizabeth, that she was missing out on motherhood and what that could bring to her life? And, you know, because motherhood can be enriching. It, like you said, it could bring Elizabeth protection. It can protect her succession, and she could have heirs that continue the succession. And that, you know, if everything would have to go well with, you know, the pregnancies and childbearing for that to happen. But do you think there was a sort of thing in the back of Catherine's mind that Elizabeth might regret not being a mother?
That's a very good question. It's very hard to answer that one, I'd say, because in terms of evidence, we would have like absolutely nothing. I mean, I know for a fact that Catherine loved her children. Maybe not equally. She definitely had favorites. She had one favorite, like the letters she wrote to Henry, who's going to become Henry III of France. It's full love, like it's full mother love. Like, I mean, you read them and you'll see what I mean. Like, she tells him like he's up to everything to her. I think she really loved Charles as well, to be fair. I think she was really close to Charles IX. But she did have a favourite with her children. So I know for a fact that on a personal level, Catherine loved being a mother and loved her children. Well, not equally, but loved being a mother and loved her children. In the letters that she sent to Elizabeth, when she talks about them, and she's going to tell Elizabeth, again, it's in my book, where she really explains the importance of being a mother to protect herself, but she doesn't mention this kind of personal aspect, and it's maybe something that would not be expected. You need to remember something else, Lauren, is that, you know, queens were usually, like, not the one nursing the babies. So all her children were taken away from her, from Catherine, and they were, even her education, she was visiting them, but she was not with them. And it was another woman, another man in charge of their education, in charge of, like, you know, making sure that they received everything they needed. So we don't, what I know is that in her letters to these people, she seems very concerned, more concerned than, you know, what you would expect from a queen. She's been to spend a lot of time thinking of how her children are. So there's obviously this strong bond. But yet, I think when it comes to Elizabeth, I think it's not really the question of missing out or not on motherhood. There's definitely a strong political agenda for Catherine. Catherine is an orphan who struggled to have children. And she didn't struggle. She thought there was a problem with her. She didn't struggle because there was a problem with her. She struggled because her husband and her didn't perform intercourse the right way. And so, again, it's in my book. And then they needed help. And Diane de Poitiers, who was kind of the second mistress, royal favorite, the queen of his heart, right, was the one helping them. Once that was sorted, they did have, like, 10 children. So, obviously, she was not fertile. Obviously, she had no problem having, you know, children, and she had them back-to-back kind of thing. And so this orphan had now suddenly a big family. And there's this desire in Catherine of having a family. And I think what grew, it was like especially when Henry II is going to die, is she becomes the matriarch of the family. She takes it very seriously. And what she wants is for a family to be spread out in all Europe. That's why she sent Elizabeth to, you know, before with her husband, they sent her to Spain. That's why, you know, she sent Claude to Lorraine. Like, she really wants Savoy, and she really wants them to be, like, in very important places. And what she didn't think that, you know, she thought Charles would live and have children, and he actually had a daughter, so she thought that maybe he'll have another boy. So she didn't think that Henry was going to be able to become king of France. You know, like, you have you obviously, when you have more than one son, you don't want them to, it would mean you're losing your sons if they were becoming king. So when she tries to marry him to Elizabeth, she really wants this dynastic thing. She wants the dynastic alliance. When Henry refused before Elizabeth, but when both refused, the marriage negotiations, like, you know, were destroyed. She made sure that he was elected. Well, she played a role in the election of King of Poland, and she was very happy he became king of another country. And then she's like, really, really, with Francis, okay, now it's you, and you're going to become King of England. Do you see what I mean? So I don't think that the policy of Elizabeth is for Elizabeth's own good. I don't think it's about missing out on motherhood. I don't think that there's this type. Also, you need to remember, Lauren, there's almost not this type of conversation, because at this time, every woman, more or less, obviously, were becoming mothers. right? And when they were not, they were accused of witchcraft. They were like, you know, seen, you know, they were outcasts of the society, right? You needed to be a mother to fit in. So for it's almost a non-question. Catherine could not imagine why Elizabeth would not want that. So when she tries to convince her, what she thinks is that Elizabeth is considering other people. What she thinks is that Elizabeth is playing games in terms of that she will eventually marry, but she might not marry one of her sons. She doesn't really imagine that Elizabeth is not marrying at all. And once she realizes that, it's obviously very late. Like, Elizabeth is in her 40s, and then, yes, okay, that she's never going to marry. And then there's, like, this where, like, the tensions between the two, well, especially from Catherine. Catherine starts despising, like, Elizabeth completely. And it's just going to grow and grow with what happens in Europe and what happens between Elizabeth and Mary. There's a shock about that Elizabeth wanted to be on free woman. I think that's really that. I think there's a lack of understanding from Catherine of why a woman would want to be, would not want to have a dynastic family, would not want to be at the head of her own family. That is really something that she doesn't understand. And it's very clear for Elizabeth. Elizabeth actually told her parliament, and I love that, she said, it's not because I have a child of my own that he will be a good king. It's not because he comes from me that he will be a good king. And I love that she said that, because it's true. Yeah. You know, there's no, you know, certainty that, you know, just because he's the son of Elizabeth I, he would be, you know, a good king. So I love that she said that. I love that, in a way, Elizabeth was very ahead of her time. I love that but you could argue that, you know, by trying to remain so much in control, she actually lacked control, because did she miss out? I don't know. It's very hard, motherhood. It's very personal as well.
So another question I've got for you is, we've talked a bit about Mary Stuart, who we know as Mary, Queen of Scots. And we've talked a bit about the relationship that the two queens had with her. So how was their relationship with Mary Stuart very different to the relationship that they had with each other in terms of how they got along and how they felt towards her as well, if we can sort of say that or put that in to some sort of...
You mean between Catherine and Mary?
Yes, how it was different from her relationship with Elizabeth.
Well, Catherine and Mary Stuart is a very different relationship, because Catherine met Mary when Mary was 6 years old. And she was brought to France, and she was brought up with the royal children. She was promised to Francis, who was going to become Francis II, so the firstborn, you know, of Catherine and Henry. But Mary showed very little respect to Catherine. She really loved and was under the protection of Diane de Poitiers, who was Catherine's nemesis. So from a very young age, there was lots of... Catherine was just like the tapestry. You know, Mary was this pretty young girl. Everyone was telling her how amazing she was. She was wonderful. She was going to become Queen of France. She, you know, the future ahead was like, you know, for her was bright and beautiful. And Diane de Poitiers was like the most beautiful woman at court, the woman who was basically queen in all but name. Catherine was just, you know, the third wheel, always in the background. No one cared about her. Very humble, very modest. And we have records, I mean, in chronicles and everything, of Diane de Poitiers and Mary kind of making fun of Catherine. So I'm not sure Catherine really liked that, because the thing that we don't realize with Catherine and Elizabeth is that all these years where they are humble, modest, show complete devotion and stuff, it's almost an act. It's a survival act, right? It's because they have no other choice. And you see their real personalities when they both become in power. And you realize that, okay, the mask drops. And they're actually, they're more intelligent than what people thought. They're more capable than what people thought. And they're the people who were disrespectful have to deal with them on another level. It's exactly what happened for Mary. When Catherine was showing, like, she was quite nice to Mary, but Mary was not that nice to Catherine. And when Francis II died in December 1560, Catherine is asking Mary to leave France, as I said. And this is a massive blow for Mary Stuart. She's really shocked by that decision. And it's going to create problem for her anyway, because she really doesn't want to go back to Scotland. And she doesn't have any choice. She does go back, but she's very upset about it. And Catherine sees Mary as a pain in the ass, definitely. And it's definitely how, like, and actually in 1561, 1562, Elizabeth and Catherine realize how dangerous Mary can be, because there are discussions of potential marriage between Mary and Don Carlos, you know, the firstborn of Philip II of Spain. And they're both like, oh my God, we cannot have Mary Stuart marrying Don Carlos, becoming Queen of Scotland, Queen of Spain. Like, it would just be an utter nightmare. Catherine is going to do everything she can with her daughter, Elizabeth of Valois, who is Queen of Spain, to put an end to that marriage negotiations. And Elizabeth is going to try very hard as well to put an end to this marriage negotiations. So you see, like, there's two, you know, Elizabeth and Catherine are, like, really agreeing on one thing. Mary is a problem. It's less a problem for Catherine than it is for Elizabeth. Though, having said that, Catherine has to deal with the Guises, and the Guises is Mary Stuart's family on the French side, and they are problematic. And she realizes that obviously all this family is problematic for everyone who is in power, that is Elizabeth or Catherine, but they choose to deal with it completely differently. What changes, though, is that Catherine doesn't have, as I said, Mary is not a threat to Catherine's life. So when Elizabeth is going to make the decision that enough is enough, and she's going to agree to the execution of her cousin, Catherine is shocked, first, by that she would consider it, but also she's scared of what it means for her son's power and the Valois dynasty in France, because the Guises are getting so much power in the 1580s in France, that by showing any kind of, like, animosity against Mary, it's showing any kind of animosity against Catholicism. And Catherine and her sons can't really afford to do that. Well, Catherine and her son, because Francis died in before 1587. So they're just like, there's a real, Catherine really wants to rescue Mary, but more for Henry's sake, Henry III's sake, more for her own sake, more for trying to gain peace in France than for, you know, Mary's own good, for example. You see what I mean? Like, I don't think there's a real care about Mary. There's a real care. The care is about making sure that
what she represents, really.
It's really about France's stability, and they will lose it. And they did lose it. When Harry died, like, it's an end game for Henry III. It's an end game for him, because he failed to rescue his former sister-in-law, and the Guises will never forgive him. And then they're gonna force him out of Paris. They're gonna besiege Paris. He's gonna have to leave. And to a point where Henry III is going to think, oh my God, I have no other choice but to order the assassination of one of them. Like, it goes completely mad. Like, after 1587 in France, it blows them out of proportion. And I think Catherine knew that. I think Catherine knew that the end of Mary Stuart would actually be the end of the Valois.
So do you think that she understood Elizabeth's decision to have her executed? Or do you think that would have been completely... She thought Elizabeth went too far.
She definitely, like, I mean, she knew that Mary was a problem, but I think she definitely, she wanted Elizabeth to find another solution. To be fair, she didn't really care what Elizabeth would come up with as long as Mary was alive. And I think that she was still shocked by her decision because, in a way, it was also very, like, it's what she said. She said, oh, my God, it is. Who does she think she is to do that? Like, she thinks she's above any other, you know, anointed monarch. Because if she can make a decision to kill another one, like, she, so there's this fear of what is Elizabeth? What has she become? And I think there's also resentment because Elizabeth is able to make decisions she wants, is able to call the shots. It, from an outside point of view, it seems like very bold and very brave and very, you know, and very like almost, you know, like careless, right? And, but we all know that it's not how it felt for Elizabeth. She knew the consequences. She was extremely scared. No one knew that they could win, like that England could win against Spain. Like no one knew that it was a possibility. So she knew that like by doing that, it would be very difficult for England. But yet, at that point, there was no other choice.
Yeah. So we've talked a bit about their personalities and the relationship that they had. And earlier this year, you contributed to the BBC's The Boleyns, a Scandalous Family. And at the end of the... at the end of the series, we have this beautiful scene, which is accompanied by, I think it's some lines of poetry by Thomas Wyatt, where Elizabeth is seen sitting outside of the Boleyn's tomb in Norwich Cathedral, reflecting on their legacy. And I know a lot is discussed about Elizabeth being her father's daughter. I mean, he executed one of his wives who was also an anointed queen, and Elizabeth did the same. But what Boleyn traits do you think Elizabeth possessed?
That's a very, like, to be, I really love that scene. It's obviously a scene taken from, you know, Lauren Mackay's book, and the reflection about, you know, Elizabeth being a Boleyn, right? Being like, remembering her mother's side of the family, which she always had, like, because obviously she put, like, her cousins and, you know, she, like, she made sure that they were well-treated and part of her court. And so, but in terms of traits, I think she, from Anne, I think they both shared a thirst for learning. I think they both loved learning, like having an education, loving languages, like all of that. I think they shared, they were both very ambitious in a good term. They wanted to do well. They wanted to do things their own way. They were both their own free women. I think that's something that really is obvious to me when I think about both Elizabeth and Anne.
That's interesting. So we've talked a bit about your book, and I know that this is your first sort of commercial book on the women, and but you have done some more academic work on the women as well, so that's also available to buy. But could you tell us a bit more about your interest as a historian and what your favourite thing is about being a historian?
Well, as you said, like I have four books before this commercial book. So I've published one academic monograph on Elizabeth and the French. I have three edited collections, and I've always been interested in queens and powerful women. That's what I think that, you know, they are like, it is fascinating for me to study power and women and how women like manage in a very strong patriarchal society to wield any type of power. I've always been fascinated with this. My latest like academic article on Louise de Lorraine Vaudémont was Henry III of France's wife and consort. Is really something that, because she's been so overlooked, so ignored, so almost written off history. And I really thought when I started writing my article that I was not going to find anything about, you know, her having any type of influence. And I could not have been more wrong, which I love. And you realize that when you really want to reassess, when you really want to reveal someone's agency, someone's influence, you really have to look at all the sources you have available. You have also to remember there are still tons of manuscripts that haven't been looked at. I mean, and there's still so much more to send, to discover about women and power. And look at Kate McCaffrey's, you know, latest works on Anne Boleyn. It really shows you that, like, it is totally possible to say something completely new, to have research completely done, you know, from scratch. And I want this to keep coming. I want future historians to keep doing it. We need more historians doing this, because I can't do it on my own. I would need, like, I don't know, 10 lives. And the other established Tudor historian, like Susanna Lipscomb, like Lauren Mackay, Owen Emerson. We don't have all, you know, we need more of us to
do all the work. I hope that I can contribute some as well, because I've been commissioned to write a book for Pen and Sword, and it's going to be about Anne Boleyn and Catherine Howard, but it's going to be about their trials and the way that they were arrested, the different types of trials that they had, and looking at the wider context of the law, and looking at the law prior to Henry's reign and during Henry's reign, and try and see if it was legal what happened to them, because he changed the law very quickly. Yeah. And some of what he did, well, could have been perceived earlier as illegal, and it wasn't necessarily the law. He didn't necessarily use the law in the way that had been designed, because when the Norman Conquest came in, they really did sort of centralise the law and sort of take away all the regional variations of the law and create one established law. And the intention was is for kings to move within the law, not sort of bulldoze it, change it to solve personal hurt. And I think that's what I want to bring, is to try and give a new perspective, is why we can't say... We can't exonerate Anne, and we can never, because I know there is a movement, or there was a few years ago, where people on Facebook wanted to have her pardoned, which is essentially not possible, because she was tried in such a very different way, because she was tried by the King's Council, which is essentially the representation of the King himself, as you know. Sorry, I'm telling you things you know. But it's very interesting to know that what happened to them possibly shouldn't happen. And then when you move to Catherine Howard, you have this question of, well, why was Parliament involved? Shouldn't that have been the church court? Because it wasn't a question of treason, it was a question of moral behavior in a marriage, which isn't a question for Parliament. So it's very different that you have Henry changing the law retrospectively after Catherine, and that he'd created these ironclad, these really tight treason laws, that Anne could have said something, you know, Anne did say something really regrettable, you know, no different to what other people would have said in a similar situation. And she gets then prosecuted for a throwaway comment. Yeah. So that's what I would like to look at as well.
That's right, exactly. And we need people who do that type of research. As I said, there's still so much more to send, to look at, on the Tudors. And I know some people think, really, like, you know, it all happened 500 years ago, surely everything has been said. And actually, no. And as you're going to prove it with your book, there are other stuff that we can look at, there are other stuff that we can question, and we need it. We just need it.
So what is your hope for your work? What do you think that you can contribute to the historiography on the Tudor period, or the 16th century, rather, because you work in different countries?
Well, I think it's just, for me, it's really about, like, trying to show more about the relations between the countries or between people. That's what I'm doing, Elizabeth and Catherine. I'm really interested into that. I'm really interested in looking not just at one country, but opening up, you know, at the relationship, the diplomatic relationship. I've always been interested in diplomacy. So I think that's how I contribute. I also really, like, I'm interested in, as I said, in female power. So continuing looking at women who are, we thought that they had little power or little influence, and bring lights into what they actually did and how they did it. So I hope that is what I'll be continuing doing, you know.
So my final question is what is next for you? What projects do you have in line, and what exciting things can we look forward to seeing from you?
Well, I can't disclose much, but there's definitely things that have been moving forward for me, for my second commercial book. I can't say more about it, but you will. There's a second book coming. I mean, I still need to write it. Like, it is coming. Otherwise, I think I would like to move a bit away from the 16th century, funny enough, at some point. Like, there are other stuff I would like to do that involves other women, but they were not born in the 16th century. And it's just continuing my love for discovering strong and powerful women and what they did.
There are plenty out there when we look for them.
Yes, definitely.
So where can we find you on social media?
Well, you can find me on Twitter, on Instagram. So it's Dr. Estelle Parenc or Estelle Parenc. You know, you just type it and you'll find me. There's only one, just me. I'm not sure it's a good thing, but it is what it is. And yes, that's my social media. And I try to post quite regularly. So if you love cats, if you love like inspirational quotes, you'll find stuff like that on my Instagram. History things are going to be on both Twitter and Instagram. So where I post about my favorite books, my favorite historians, and obviously about my work.
And where can we buy your book from? I know that at the moment that you're doing a signed edition with Fox Lane Books, who I absolutely adore. I get all my books from there. They're fantastic. And I'm always advertising them on the podcast as well.
Yes, I love them too. So yes, I'm doing, I'm signing books for them. And I'm going to sign book for Goldsboro's Books as well. And it's a bookshop in London. But yeah, you can find it on Waterstones. Obviously Amazon, I mean, it's not great, but you can. Book Depository, you can find it anywhere, I think, in all bookshops and everything. So hopefully it will be big.
So I'm just going to ask Brian, do you have any questions?
I do, actually. Yeah. this has been incredible. I have two questions. One, I have been wanting to do a show for a while on the diplomacy between Spain and France and England at this time and how complicated that had to have been. I think there might be someone in this conversation who would be the perfect guest for that down the road, and would you be willing to do that?
Yes, I mean, at some point, yeah, definitely. It is a very complicated relationship, diplomatic relationship.
Lauren Mackay would be a good person to bring on as well.
Yes, it's a good book, actually, on Spain and Ottoman Empire and France and England. So, yes, Lauren Mackay is definitely also someone that has lots to contribute on that question.
And the other question I had, I was thinking about this as you were talking, that Catherine was pretty ballsy for a very patriarchal society. How did Parliament let her get away with that? I mean, because, yeah, she was the queen, she had the power, but still, this was a time when she probably, to most people, shouldn't have had that.
That's a good question. I don't think that she was that ballsy. I think she was, like, very good at building a circle of advisors that would be loyal to her. And it's what she did when she was queen consort, and very devoted and very humble and very modest. So when she became, you know, queen mother of France, she had these people who were not like, who were happy to be working with her. They didn't realize, to be that, you know what, I just don't think that she wanted power to secure a dynasty, to secure a family. I don't think she loved power just for the sake of power. So I think it was easy for men who were like advisors, councillors in Privy Council in France to accept her. And I think she just had this bad reputation of being too, you know, too bold and everything. Because she did lose her temper a few times. But Elizabeth did too, okay? So it's not just Catherine. And I actually like that about both of them.
I love that about both of them.
Elizabeth lost her temper so badly that one councillor said that he, you know, that he wouldn't have been expected to have been treated like this by her father, which is saying something.
Yes, but to be fair, like, they were super annoying.
Yes.
I mean, I'm sure that they haven't recorded half of what she's done for both Catherine and Elizabeth, but honestly, some men were absolutely disrespectful, and I think she had to tell them, you know, who do you think you're talking to? You know, you would not. I've never talked like that to my father, Henry VIII, or for Catherine, my husband, Henry II. So I think you have to put that into context, that what was shocking is it was what a woman would tell them, you know, not to be like this. You see what I mean? I don't, but if it had been a man, it would have, no one would have made that comment. So it's really about the patriarchal society and the preconceptions about women and power, right?
Well, she was so much smarter than most people would have thought she could be.
Yeah, she, both Catherine and Elizabeth were much smarter than people thought at the time.
Catherine just always, I was like, wow, you are bold and brave and smart and impressive, and that's just, wow. I always thought everything you read about Catherine, that's all I walk away with saying is, wow. But that was my questions.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think that's everything now. Do you want to wrap it up, Brian?
No, we are good. Just this was amazing. Okay. I love this.
Yeah.
So I hope we can talk again soon.
Oh, absolutely. I hope that you stay in touch with us and that you're happy to come on again, because it was really enjoyable. I really enjoyed speaking to you.
Me too. Thank you so much, guys, for having me.
You're very welcome. And looking forward to the book. Oh, it's going to be amazing. It's such a fantastic concept, and I'm so excited.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'll see you soon. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. Bye.
Okay,
how
Lauren,
that
was incredible.
Oh, I'm so glad. I'm glad you enjoyed your day off, because I felt a bit bad yesterday. But it's a very busy time, so if anything comes up, like with student conduct boards and stuff like that, it would be a very quick thing now, because they're trying to get everything out by the beginning of July. So she was very apologetic.
Oh, no problem. I'm just thrilled we were able to do this, and sorry I couldn't pop on till the very end, but, you know, it was 4 in the morning here, so that's okay. But, she is absolutely incredible. I cannot wait to read that book.
It is amazing.
Like I said, Catherine has always been one of those people that has always fascinated me, because she is just so, wow. That's the only words I can ever use to describe her, because she was incredibly smart, incredibly ruthless, incredibly brave. She's pretty badass.
Right, I better let you go back to bed now.
Well, I can't. I'm going to start working them on now. I got the coffee brewing, Cleo's begging for breakfast, and, you know, that's pretty groovy, so... What do you say we sign off, Lauren?
I think that might be best for you.
All right, so. From Brian in Buffalo.
And Lauren in Swansea.
Good night.
Good night. Well, good morning. I like the Holy Roman Empire.